Radio.
Pub Theology is a monthly get-together held at the Dan O'Connell Hotel in North Adelaide. 20-somethings meet up to hear engaging speakers give straight talk, hard facts, and real answers on the Catholic faith. Right now, you're listening to the best of Pub Theology on cradio.org.au.
Thank you for that, Patrick. And I would like to thank Michael for inviting me to speak here tonight. I'm just actually at the beginning of my academic career, so to speak. I've just recently arrived in Melbourne and started working at the Institute in the last couple months, so I'm more than happy to do a bit of traveling and speak a little bit with what I've spent the last number of years learning. It's great to see so many of you out tonight. Pub Theology is very impressive, the amount of people that it brings out. I guess when you add theology to your beer, good things happen. Or, of course, it might be the opposite. Beer might make theology that much better, but you can be the judge of that tonight. Now, as Patrick mentioned, tonight's talk is on the basis of postmodernism, focusing on Nietzsche's attack on Christianity. And those of us familiar with Friedrich Wilhelm Nietzsche, that famously dark and brooding philosopher of the 19th century, we likely know about him in relation to his attack on Christianity. He famously called Christianity the religion of the herd, the slave, the religion for the weak. And we also think of Nietzsche's Übermensch, or Superman, or Overman. And we think about Nietzsche in relation to, say, the horrors of Nazism. So Nietzsche brings to mind some pretty foundational stuff. He's very much a threat to our Christian belief. And because of that, he causes us to think very deeply about what we believe in. Now, one way of dealing with Nietzsche is to simply dismiss him on the basis that he is an evil man. So from a Christian perspective, he's a nihilist hack. He's a degenerate believer in nothing. And we should therefore either attack him or simply ignore him. Indeed, it would be dangerous to engage with anything he said on this interpretation for fear that our own serenity of faith could be tainted. So here the idea is Nietzsche's a threat, and we need to avoid anything to do with him in order for our faith to remain strong. But what I want to talk about tonight is proposing another alternative, an alternative way of approaching Nietzsche. This way understands Nietzsche as a profound prophet who unmasks what I will call the therapeutic dimension of modern existence. And as we go along, I'll make clear what exactly that is. But the idea is that Nietzsche challenges all forms of existence that merely get by without fully coming to grips with the true drama of existence. So Nietzsche challenges the Christian on this basis, saying that Christianity is merely a way of getting by without asking those really deep questions that basically call everything we believe into question. So do we have faith simply because that is what our parents taught us? Do we have faith simply because of the fluffy consolations that it may offer us? Or do we use faith as an excuse to avoid a deeper grappling with life's existential questions? For what I want to argue tonight is that to truly live, we must existentially, that is personally, face up to our human condition, to our finitude, our mortality. To live is to stare at the abyss, to confront suffering and evil, our deepest sense of truth and lie. Now, sure, we can delude ourselves. We can get by. But I want to argue that the person who simply gets by, who simply believes because that seems to be the logical thing to do, that seems to be the thing that everyone is doing around us, that person does not face his own true greatness. This is the person who is content with the shadows on the wall, as Plato put it, and not with the real deal. If we search our hearts deeply enough, we may find that there is a Nietzsche somewhere in all of us. That is, there is a doubt that haunts the very depth of our hearts, a fear that perhaps all that I believe is merely an illusion. Thus, Nietzsche voices our own often hidden crisis of faith. Is what I believe in truly worth hanging on to? Or is it all just a massive deception? So Nietzsche very much brings us to the breaking point. He brings us to the edge of the abyss, an edge that can mean the end of faith, or alternatively, as I want to argue tonight, to a dramatic recovery of faith. So what I want to do tonight is bring us to the edge of that abyss with Nietzsche. If we talk about Nietzsche, we've got to be prepared to ask the really difficult questions. So to do this, along the way, I'll familiarize you with some of the basic teachings of Nietzsche and the way he provides inspiration for what we now call postmodernism. So I want to bring you to the edge of the abyss, and I also want to give you a bit of a broad sweep of what Nietzsche actually taught. So finally, once we end up in the pit of despair with Nietzsche, so to speak, I will ask, is it possible to tell a better story than the one told by Nietzsche? And what would this story look like? So let's begin. As suggested, Nietzsche has captured the imagination of anybody who is dissatisfied with the story that their religion or their culture tells them. So Nietzsche's stories simultaneously subvert the rival stories and empower the subjects who feel trapped in such stories. Nietzsche particularly speaks powerfully to the difficulty of Christian belief today, for us for whom belief itself has become problematic. If you look around the culture at large, the very notion of belief, particularly religious belief, is inherently problematic today. And consider this quote of Nietzsche's in relation to this difficulty of belief in basically the fundamental tenet of the Christian faith. He asks, "When on a Sunday morning we hear the old bells sounding, we ask ourselves, is it really possible? For this all has to do with a crucified Jew of 2,000 years ago who said that he was the Son of God." Now, who among us has not had these thoughts? There's no point in denying the basic realism of Nietzsche's claim. We have all been there. We have all faced that doubt. Many of us are there now, and all of us are there on any given days of our lives. Faith is hard. It's not always the warm, fuzzy feeling of basking in God's presence. On the contrary, faith is hard because life itself is hard. Life is tragic, and we just have to face that. For all the joys and pleasures that life brings, at its end lies death, with all the horror of non-being that this represents. Herein lies the horror. To be is to be towards death. And along this road to death lies suffering. We face horrors in this world of such magnitude that it can literally drive us mad. We face evils that make the good seem an illusion. How can belief, that is belief in a good God, be possible in such a world? These are the sort of questions that Nietzsche forces us to confront. I speak in these stark terms because Nietzsche, like, say, Soren Kierkegaard before him, clearly understood the extent to which we anesthetize ourselves to the drama of existence. We naturally wish to avoid the horrors of evil and suffering. And so we prioritize anything that enables us to forget this existential unease. Anything that helps feed the illusion that we are somehow immune to this raw edge of existence, that we are secure from the threat of death. So we settle for the solution that allows us to go on living without facing the truly existential questions. Suffering and evil can drive us mad, so we deal with them, or we get by losing ourselves in the mundane. We seek pleasure, suburban values, wealth, iPhones, technology, the very act of consumption itself. You name it, anything that dulls the pain, we will use to prevent ourselves from asking the truly deep questions. So what I want to argue that Nietzsche so clearly brings out is that we deal with the horror of existence through therapy. Now, I don't mean therapy as a legitimate means of helping us through a difficult time, say. I mean therapy as a way of avoiding these fundamental questions. So when I talk about therapy, If there's any psychiatrists out there, don't be offended. I'm talking about a bad therapy. So we thus hide behind anything that interrupts our therapeutic self-medicating. We hide death between the artificial smiles of undertakers and euphemisms such as passing away. We institutionalize illness and shun the unborn and elderly because they remind us of our humble beginnings and our mortality, thus interrupting our therapy. Kierkegaard spoke of such coping mechanisms as the sickness unto death, a form of unconfronted despair, a choice for a hollow shell of inauthentic existence. So what is Nietzsche going to say about all this? Nietzsche is not interested in a life under the influence of a therapeutic anesthetic. He wants no part in any coping strategy that deadens the sharp edge of human existence. For the very existence of any and all coping mechanisms originates in the herd mentality of the slave. And here we look at one of Nietzsche's key ideas, the notion that the slave is the weak person who cannot face the horrors of existence and substitutes therapy for reality. The slave is the one who requires others to do his thinking. The slave is the one who cannot bear the weight of existence and who therefore fabricates stories to deal with such an existence. But the slave is not capable of telling these stories on his own. The slave must fabricate his stories on the basis of what others have already said. The stories of the slave are thus the weak or negative version of the stories of those able to bear the weight of the horror of existence, who Nietzsche called the masters or the übermensch, the overmen. So the slave sees these overmen who are able to deal in a noble, strong way with these existential questions, and they invert it and subvert it, and we'll look at that in a second. But first, what is the übermensch? The übermensch is a stronger species, a higher type that arises and preserves itself under different conditions from those of the average man, the slave. The stories told by this master class of supermen are stories that do not attempt to mask the horror of existence. Instead, the übermensch grasps and accepts the inner meaninglessness of existence. And instead of shrinking from this in terror, embraces it with power, greatness, and nobility. The superman is the one who creates values based on the affirmation of life through the superior and defiant act of his will. So what are these values of the übermensch? The overman is what Nietzsche called Dionysiac in his approach to life. Nietzsche plays with the idea in Greek mythology of the god Apollo on the one hand and the god Dionysus on the other. Apollo has everything to do with reason, with rational restraint, with measure. Dionysus is the god of excess, intoxication, madness. And it's precisely Dionysus who Nietzsche sees as emblematic of this übermensch class of beings. So the mark of the übermensch is intoxication, madness, excess, and the exercise of absolute freedom. These are the marks of the übermensch, to respond in strength and power to the horror of existence, to shape reality to one's desired ends. So do not let any false moralism dictate how you're going to live your life. Do not live your life in fear of ultimate questions, for the answer to these questions is ultimately non-existent. So the overman is lightning, madness, and creator of his own destiny. He's a source of all meaning and value. He doesn't ask these questions. He doesn't try to deal with them at the same time. He responds to them by creating his own reality, by making himself, in a sense, a god. So this higher species of the übermensch, they don't need any crutches. They don't need any training wheels. They're their own men. They do as they please. They make up their own stories. Now, in contrast to the übermensch, the stories of the slave are a form of defeatism. The slave tells the story of the values of the herd, of those incapable of grabbing life by the horns, so to speak. Unlike the overmen, the slave morality of the weak must seek any and all crutches that can be found in order to impose order into the chaos of existence. It is at this point that Nietzsche makes his boldest stroke, a stroke that most of us here are probably familiar with, or at least have heard. For he begins to speak of God, the Christian God in particular, as little more than a pale, wimpy, cowardly subversion of the godlike stance of the Übermensch. In other words, who we now call God is merely a crutch devised by the weak to support their own existence. And Nietzsche says, "For every religion was born out of fear and need. It has crept into existence along paths of aberrations of reasons." And in any sort of contemporary cultural discourse, I mean, that's the common narrative when it comes to religion. It's basically something that's been imagined to deal with our own inability to face up to the reality of a godless existence. So the real God, according to Nietzsche, if we can even speak about a God, is the Übermensch. The false God is the God devised by the weak to justify their own need for foundation and order. Now Nietzsche's parable of the madman illustrates this point in very clear, very vivid terms. He tells the tale of a madman who bursts into a village and asks frantically, "Whither is God?" After enduring the quite normal and logical jeering of and mocking of the villagers, the madman pierces them with his eyes and answers his own query. And this is what he says, "I will tell you, we have killed him, you and I. All of us are his murderers. God is dead. God remains dead, and we have killed him." So the madman can see what no one else can, or what no one else will admit, that the God of the weak, the Christian God, is little more than a form of therapy, supporting our own weak response to the real. Now, famously for Nietzsche, the death of God is not to be mourned or lamented. The madman says, "There has never been a greater deed, and whatever is born after us, for the sake of this deed, he will belong to a higher history than all history hitherto." For the death of God is the opportunity for the Übermensch to bring about what Nietzsche calls a transvaluation of values. For us to finally be able to kill God after so many centuries of captivity is to become mature and manly enough to cast away our training wheels. The death of God for Nietzsche is therefore a form of liberation from the anti-values of the weak. Nietzsche heaps scorn on these latter slave values, seeing them as fundamentally life-denying. In particular, Christianity is the anti-value writ large, the most massive deception in human history, what one commentator recently described in Nietzschean terms as a desperate worship of otherworldliness for fear of any real change and a revolutionary transformation. Its ethic is essentially an attack on any higher way of living, any affirmation of life. Nietzsche declares that you should not beautify Christianity or try to dress it up. It has waged a war to the death against this higher type of person, the Übermensch. It has banned all the basic instincts of this type. It has distilled evil and the evil one out of these instincts. The strong human being as reprehensible, as depraved. Christianity has taken the side of everything weak, base, failed. It has made an ideal out of whatever contradicts the preservation instincts of a strong life. Elsewhere, Nietzsche complains that pity or mercy is one of the most appalling and life-denying aspects of Christianity. For as he says, pity has a depressive effect. You lose strength when you pity. And pity further intensifies and multiplies the loss of strength, which in itself brings suffering to life. Pity preserves those things that are ripe for decline. It defends things that have been disowned and condemned by life, and it gives a depressive and questionable character to life itself by keeping alive an abundance of failures of every type. So Nietzsche's world is a world of strength. It is a world without women and without children. With this last comment, we can begin to really see the radical edge of Nietzsche's proclamation. We can begin to see the horrible possibilities that lurk within the psyche of one who is truly prepared to follow Nietzsche seriously or take his ideas into the practical realm. Nazism, again, is probably the most obvious example of Nietzschean values being used towards a truly horrific end. But this is precisely Nietzsche's point. The one strong enough to reject the illusion of therapy will accept the radical consequences of the groundlessness of human existence. Everyone else is still in therapy. Now, what bothered Nietzsche most about what we now call the modern world was its hypocrisy. It was what we today call the culture of modernity or the Enlightenment Project that, in fact, for Nietzsche, ended up killing God. The main goal of modernity was to create the possibility of a world where one could live as if God did not exist. So in place of God, the modern world proposes a pure reason capable of grounding itself without reference to God. Nietzsche hates modernity as much as or more than he hates Christianity. For modernity accepts the thesis that God is dead implicitly, but it fails to live up to the consequences of this fact. It is thus a form of nihilistic cowardice, even more hypocritical than Christianity. Christians, at least those of us not living our faith simply as a mask, at least believe that the God they worship is not an illusion. And so those of us who become aware of the therapy of modern existence, of all the way we simply deal with these big questions, of the ways we get by, those of us can fall into a kind of postmodern despair. So we can call postmodernism the disillusionment with the big stories, the story told by Christianity, the story told by modernity. So postmodernism is the rejection of big stories as such and posits only little stories, disconnected fragments of meaning that lie in a permanent state of groundlessness. So it's sort of like you put everything in a state of suspension. You hear a claim, okay, I'm never going to come to the ultimate answer to this claim. I'm just going to have to let it sit there. I can't make any ultimate judgment on anything. So postmodernism is a suspension or deferral of questions of ultimate meaning and the seeking of meaning in little stories with no guiding plot, consisting of the pursuit of the ephemeral or the kick that somehow takes one, however temporarily, outside of the mundane, outside of the world of therapeutic lies. So Nietzsche is called the father of postmodernism because it is he who so brilliantly diagnosed the sickness of modern life. Nietzsche looked around him and saw nothing but therapeutic self-medicating. Nietzsche thus dedicates his life to unmasking this massive deception. And insofar as he recognizes so many people living a lie, Nietzsche's critique has therefore been called by one commentator a form of prophetic irrationalism. The postmodern soul is the one who keenly perceives the emptiness of the stories told by modern life. The postmodern soul is one who rejects all forms of therapy. Back in 2005, the American punk rock band Green Day released a single called Jesus of Suburbia. Now, this song tells the story of a certain Jesus, a sort of Nietzschean prophet, crying out with his disillusionment with the worn-out Christian and modern values that he sees all around him. So I want to read you the text of this song because it sort of encapsulates this sort of postmodern despair with the big stories that are told by Christianity and modernity. So this character, Jesus, says the following. I'm the son of rage and love, the Jesus of suburbia, from the Bible of none of the above, on a steady diet of soda pop and Ritalin. No one ever died for my sins in hell, as far as I can tell, at least the ones I got away with. And there's nothing wrong with me. This is how I'm supposed to be, in a land of make-believe that don't believe in me. Get my television fix, sitting on my crucifix, the living room in my private womb while the mums and dads are away. To fall in love and fall in debt, to alcohol and cigarettes, and Mary Jane keeping me insane, doing someone else's cocaine. And there's nothing wrong with me. This is how I'm supposed to be, in the land of make-believe that don't believe in me. Like the center of the earth in the parking lot of the 7-Eleven where I was taught, The motto was just a lie. It says, home is where your heart is. But what a shame, because everyone's heart doesn't beat the same. It's beating out of time. City of the dead, at the end of another lost highway, signs misleading to nowhere. City of the damned, lost children with dirty faces today. No one really seems to care. I read the graffiti in the bathroom stall like the holy scriptures of the shopping mall. So it seemed to confess, it didn't say much, but it only confirmed that the center of the earth is the end of the world, and I could really care less. At the end of another lost highway, signs misleading to nowhere, city of the damned, lost children with dirty faces today, no one really seems to care. Everyone's so full of shit, born and raised by hypocrites, hearts recycled but never saved, from the cradle to the grave. We are the kids of war and peace, from England to the Middle East. We are the stories and disciples of the Jesus of suburbia. Dearly beloved, are you listening? I can't remember a word that you were saying. Are we demented or am I disturbed? The space that's in between insane and insecure. Oh, therapy, can you please fill the void? Am I retarded or am I just overjoyed? Nobody's perfect and I stand accused. For lack of a better word, and that's my best excuse. To live and not to breathe is to die in tragedy. To run away, to find what you believe. And I leave behind this hurricane of effing lies. I lost my faith to this town that don't exist. So I run away to the light of masochist, and I leave behind this hurricane of lies. And I walk this line 1,000,001 times, but not this time. I don't feel any shame, I won't apologize, when there ain't nowhere we can go running away from the pain, when we've been victimized, tales from another broken home. So it doesn't get much more despairing and disillusioned with that, with those lyrics. In particular, think of the one line, to live and not to breathe is to die in tragedy. And this is pure Nietzsche. It bespeaks a radical dissatisfaction with the story of human happiness that is being offered. It expresses the conviction that there must therefore be something more. The modern story is dull and flat. It fails to excite my desire and imagination. It fails to answer my deepest questions. It fails to draw out true greatness from the human soul. So there's the depressing part. Let's see if we can pull ourselves out of the abyss. So at this point with Nietzsche, we stand at a crisis of faith, a crisis of belief at the edge of the abyss. Nietzsche has professed to unmask our idols, challenge our horizons, and sharpen our awareness of our existential predicament. The truly interesting question after all of this is, where do we go from here? Do we go all the way with Nietzsche? We can perhaps agree with Nietzsche and with Green Day that modern life saps our vital force, that it diminishes our greatness, and that it is ultimately a form of therapeutic nihilism. So the Christian must ask him or herself the following. Is our Christian faith itself a form of living without breathing? Is it a form of deception, a mythological mirroring of our own weakness, a nihilistic therapy? Even if we may be happy with the way that Nietzsche unmasks the hypocrisy of modern life, we must face the fact that we as Christians remain Nietzsche's prime target. It is our faith that Nietzsche challenges, and not only the degenerate faith of modern life. On this level, our only way forward is to test what we believe. Does all that faith represents really and truly embody the annihilation of life, the elimination of eros, the sublimation of the human person's appetite for greatness? So in response to Nietzsche, I want to sketch one alternative story. But I do not want to tell a story based on proof, at least as what we call proof is conventionally understood, as a kind of rational, airtight demonstration that sort of brings to end definitively the conversation. For all truly great questions do not admit of proofs, such proofs as answers. For the truly searching existential questions, the kind of questions that Nietzsche forces us to ask, These are the questions that flow from the anguished heart of the despairing. And they challenge the text, the written word, the syllogism, or the proposition. The question that Nietzsche provokes makes the glib and clever answers of the philosopher or the theologian irrelevant, perhaps. One does not simply provide the proofs of God's existence for the soul for whom reality itself has ceased to be rational. Such a thing would merely drive the person deeper into the pit of despair, a cold, impersonal smack upside the head. So tonight, let me try something different. The person facing the abyss needs first and foremost reassurance that reality at its most basic is something worthy of trust, that what we call being is a warm embrace and not a cold shoulder. In a word, the despairing person needs beauty. Nietzsche, of course, took the view that reality, that being, was in fact a cold shoulder. For him, reality is simply power, force, and will. For him, beauty is an illusion, itself a form of therapy. But let's test him. Is reality really and truly simply power, force, and will? Or are these the bastard copy, the false reality, the mutant form of something far deeper? Let's consider an alternative, one that I particularly loved and really dramatically shaped my own theological formation. And I'll read a series of quotes from Swiss theologian Hans Urs von Balthasar, who provides what I think of as a very good answer to the sort of questions Nietzsche raises. So savor these words, let them sink in. This is what he says. After a mother has smiled at her child for many days and weeks, she finally receives her child's smile in response. She has awakened love in the heart of her child, and as the child awakens to love, it also awakens to knowledge. Knowledge comes into play because the play of love has already begun beforehand, initiated by the mother, the transcendent. The child's I awakens in the experience of a thou. In its mother's smile, through which it learns that it is contained, affirmed, and loved, in a relationship which is incomprehensibly encompassing, already actual, sheltering, and nourishing. The body which it snuggles into, a soft, warm, and nourishing kiss, is a kiss of love in which it can take shelter because it has been sheltered there from the first. This little child does not consider whether it will reply with love or non-love to its mother's inviting smile. For just as the sun entices forth green growth, so does love awaken love. It is the movement towards the thou and the I that the I becomes aware of itself. The child at its mother's breast is, first of all, something of a repetition of their bond while in the womb. And yet this unity of love persists even when the mother's face smiles at the child at a distance. Here is where the miracle occurs that one day the child will recognize in its mother's face her protective love and will reciprocate this love with a first smile. Before making any judgment or coming to any conclusion, we must marvel, as at a miracle, at the perfect and immediate intuition which here is operative. Love is understood to be the most pristine source of all. This understanding opens up in the child the dormant bud of self-awareness. The love between a thou and an I inaugurates the reality of a world which is deeper than simply being because of its absolute boundlessness and plenitude. Some dense but profound words. And this is what I want to submit to you here today. The answer to Nietzsche, the answer to the doubting and despairing heart, is quite simply the smile of the mother. For the mother's smile is love, unconditional love. The mother's smile is reality at its most pristine and primordial. For who can doubt the smile of a mother gazing at her newborn child? There is nothing duplicit about that smile. That is true love, true warmth and acceptance. The child who gazes up at this tender, joyful smile, who snuggles into his mother's warm breast, knows only love. Reality for this child is a sort of letting be, a bathing in the warm glow of his mother's nurturing care and attention. So being in this relationship of dependency is not constrictive, for the mother's smile is precisely that which awakens the consciousness of the child. The mother's smile is the gift that opens the world for her child. Her smile tells her child that he is loved, that existence is good, that existence is true, and that existence is beautiful. So against Nietzsche, then, we can say that the child's weakness, precisely the sort of weakness that Nietzsche hates so much, is a weakness that is actually strength. It is the weakness of love, a love that fulfills, that stimulates growth, and that binds one in a relationship. Yes, the child's existence lies in debt to her mother. But the important fact here is that the mother never calls in the loan. The child does not feel threatened by her dependency on her mother, for this dependency is one totally and utterly irradiated by love. The child's dependency is precisely the condition of her flourishing. So with these insights, we can begin to subvert Nietzsche's understanding of strength and weakness. The mother's smile reveals that the truly great person is the one who intimately understands and submits himself to the reality of love perceived in that smile. The strong person is the one courageous enough to recognize the false illusion that is self-sufficiency, force, power, and will. The strong person understands that true fulfillment lies in being in relation, being loved. Von Balthasar refers to the fact that all human potential is merely the unfolding, or is merely meant to be the unfolding, of that first basic experience of the mother's smile. So an authentically Christian understanding of weakness, then, is one where the Christian knows that God himself is love. It is the knowledge that God is love that allows the Christian to say, "My strength is made perfect in weakness." By contrast, against Nietzsche, the weak person is the one who lives under the illusion, or the consciously deliberate choice, that reality is in fact power, force, and will. This is the person who either rejects the mother's smile, or tragically, who has never experienced the mother's smile in the first place. This person's no to love is premised on the experience of the world as darkness, emptiness, and fear, where motherhood is absent. In this world, vulnerability and dependence are to be avoided at all costs. So one must here hide behind the power of one's will as a defense. Dependence and vulnerability are simply the opportunity for others to use and abuse you. The other is seen as a threat, and I must therefore shape reality through the weight of my will to create a reality where I will not be threatened. And here is the key point. Therapy, therefore, is not the domain of Christianity. It is the domain of the Übermensch. For us to understand that God is love, to understand that God's love is something like the love of a mother for her child, is to radically turn Nietzsche on his head. Christianity, at least in its authentic manifestation, is not therapy for the weak. The care for the suffering and the weak, the concern for the widow and the orphan, the rejection of violence, these all flow from the profound awareness that reality itself is gift and love, that it is the mother's smile. The Christian preoccupation with weakness does not stem from any resentment or from the inability to be truly great. Rather, it stems from this profound intuition that all that is love, and that the mission of the Christian is to bring this love to the ends of the earth, to recover and transmit the mother's smile. The genius of Christianity, the genius of Christ, is to have unmasked the naked violence and horror that lie within the Nietzschean worldview, a worldview premised precisely on the rejection of the mother's smile. So let me conclude. The story, of course, does not end with the mother's smile. But for the despairing heart who feels that there is nothing left living for, the mother's smile is the beginning, the first stop on the way to the love of Christ. And so the answer to the abyss, the answer to the pit of despair, the answer to violence, power, and force, is submitting oneself to the reality of the mother's smile. This, in a nutshell, is what I hope to have accomplished or begun to accomplish in this talk. To truly live and to truly breathe is to live in the light of the mother's smile. So I think we'll leave it at that. And I hope, Monsignor, that I have used my imagination to a good end in this talk. Thank you.
You've been listening to the best of Pub Theology on credio.org.au. Pub Theology is a monthly get-together held at the Dan O'Connell Hotel in North Adelaide. 20-somethings meet up to hear engaging speakers give straight talk, hard facts, and real answers on the Catholic faith. For more Catholic radio, visit our website or download our podcasts, credio.org.au. Nourishing the soul of the digital generation.